We've met Paul through a rather large introduction, a long introduction going on for 15 verses in Romans. And he's writing to believers, and he's talking about what they've all experienced, the salvation of God. So you might say, he's preaching to the choir here. Why is he saying all this? He knows it, they know it, and so forth. Well, he tells us because there's something in the gospel itself. It is the power of God, verse 16 tells us, for salvation to everyone who believes. It is the power of God for salvation. But when he begins to speak about the gospel, he kind of gives it a weak and pathetic introduction. He says, I'm not ashamed of it. And last week, you remember, I said, suppose you have, you're introducing somebody to your mother or to your boss or to somebody like that, and you say, this is so-and-so, and the first thing I want you to know about this person is that I'm not ashamed of them. The people would think, what's wrong with either this guy introducing or with the mother? So we looked at that. Not ashamed of it, because the gospel is weak and foolish in the eyes of everybody. You say, not in my eyes, I'm a Christian. It is because you've sinned this week, even this day. I told you last week about fussing and fuming when I tried to tie a bow tie. I was doing it this morning, trying to tie this tie, fussing and fuming in the mirror. I said, I'm going to go preach the Holy Gospel, and here I am fussing at the mirror, and myself in the mirror. And so I think, why would I listen to the gospel? It's foolish, and it's weak. It doesn't fit the realities of my life, even down to the little detail of trying to tie a necktie. But Paul says, I'm not ashamed of it. And it's not because the gospel is actually has nothing to do with shame. It's all about shame. It's all about God taking on our shame. And we have plenty of shame. The very first thing that the first sinners in the world sensed was not that I've rebelled against God, I'm guilty before God, I've offended God's holiness. It wasn't about God at all. It was entirely about themselves. They were ashamed. They were ashamed. And the gospel is that God takes that shame and gives us his power and his wisdom and his might and his majesty. He dies and dies in an excruciating way and suffers judgment and whatever is entailed in that and in afterlife for those, as Paul says, who believe. Sometimes we're urged, accept this gospel, accept this gift. That's a waste of time and breath. Because if we really believe what the Bible says, sinners are dead in trespasses and sins. They're not amenable to anything. So to say, accept this gift and you will be saved. No. Peter didn't preach that on the day of Pentecost. Accept this gift and you'll be saved. He just told them what God had done. And then they said, what must we do to be saved? And then he knew, I'm talking to people who've already come back from the dead. They want to know, now how do I live this new life? Paul writes to believers, saying he's not ashamed of the gospel, and he's not ashamed for good reasons. The gospel is unto salvation. But salvation from what? That's what we have to ask ourselves, and that's what our passage is about today. Salvation from what? All right, so I borrow $5 from you. Now I'm in debt to you. And I begin to be troubled about that. You know, I owe him $5, but I don't have it today, and I don't see where I'm going to have it tomorrow. I pay all my bills, my bank account's emptied out, I'm in debt, $5. Somebody comes along and says, why are you upset today? I owe so-and-so $5. Here, take this. In fact, you probably don't remember, but I owe you $5. Take this and then give it to your friend. And everything's squared. All right, what's going to happen? For $5, a $5 debt being relieved, that's going to make my day. I'm going to think, now I don't have to kind of act like I don't see him when we're walking down the sidewalk or something like that. I'm happy. $5 debt. Is this up to that level? Is the salvation that's proclaimed in the gospel up to a $5 level? Well, the way that we treat it says it's not. It's worthless. It is something shameful. But Paul goes on to demonstrate that it isn't. And that it's glorious. And why? And what we're saved from. I don't care what your problem is today. You may be dying of cancer today. And you may know it. You may have committed some crime. And you're hoping you don't get caught. You may have disobeyed your parents if you're a child and broken something, and you're just waiting for them to find out and what kind of punishment you're going to get. It doesn't matter what your problem is. It doesn't matter if suddenly we hear strange noises and we wonder, what are those sounds going off? And what they are is they're telling us we've got about 18 minutes before we're incinerated by an intercontinental ballistic missile. But we don't know what even the warning is because it hasn't been tested in so long. I don't care what our problem is. Nothing measures up to this problem in who we are. The chances of us being incinerated today are minimal to non-existent today. And all these other problems have their solutions. But who we are, what are we going to do about that? What are we going to do about the fact that even the best of us, keeping ourselves in the best of shape, we're going to die? We're going to die. And it's not necessarily that people are going to shoot us or stab us. We just die. For some reason, reach a point and we stop growing. We start getting weaker. We start disintegrating. And then we die. That's a pretty big problem. What if the solution said, you don't have to die? Or you die, but you find out it's very different on the other side of things than you thought it would be. I would submit that this is a big problem that's addressed. Now, whether this gospel is the solution to it remains to be seen. But it's a big problem. What if I told you I could give you eternal life? What if I told you I could make you right in every situation you face for the rest of your life? I could make you guiltless for everything. You don't have to apologize to anybody for anything. You'll do it because You'll be in a new awareness of the reality of your own being and the freedom that you have from shame that you're now going to great lengths to cover up and to hide. What if I said that was for? Who here would say, I don't want that. Leave me alone. Everybody here wants that. Is the gospel capable of providing that? Let's see. The gospel saves us from a word that even to Christians, you know, we talk about sin, and even we tend to kind of think, in the end of the day, what does that word mean? What does it mean? It's kind of a quaint word. It's a religious word. And, you know, we live in a day when we can do a lot of stuff. We can send spaceships up. We can talk to people through WhatsApp on the other side of the world, and it doesn't cost anything, except you lose a lot of your personal information in the process. But, you know, what is sin? Sin is not my problem. You wake up today and did you think, I'm a sinner. That's my big problem. No. You woke up and you thought, I still owe my neighbor $5. That's what we wake up thinking. Or, I hope I have enough gas in the car. These are our challenges. These are the great challenges of our lives. The gospel claims to save us from sin. Sin in two areas. One, sin that is innate, meaning it's in us. It is essential to us. It is what we are. It's not just what we do. But then, because we are sinners, sin actual, that we call transgressions. We've actually done wrong things. Now, this is addressed from this verse 18 that we read this morning all the way through to chapter 3, verse 23. What is sin? And who commits sin? And who is a sinner? That's what that's all about. And nobody can stand up to it. If you're squeamish about yourself and you're nervous and you're anxious and you're not secure in yourself, give the next few weeks a miss. Stay away for a while, because you're going to see yourself like you've never seen yourself before. And you're not going to like it. You're going to be shocked. You're going to be amazed. You're not going to like it. You say, but I'm a Christian. I'm a Christian. Yeah. It's going to still work that way. So if you're squeamish, don't come to church. Go to some other church or go watch a movie or something like that. But I'm telling you, I'm warning you, don't come here. Okay? This is as happy as it's going to get for a while. Sin is something of which truly we have to be ashamed, whether we realize the word or not. I'm walking my dog one morning, and I it's rained the night before, and the leaves are sort of dripping. And I walk, and I feel something on my shoulder. And I thought, oh, man, the tree dripped on me because of the rain. Something told me, that little voice that we all have. We don't listen to it, but, the more you listen to it, the more you find this works pretty well in making me aware of things that are there that I wasn't just aware of before. Look at your shoulder. I wonder if that was a bird dropping on me. Sure enough, it was a bird dropping, and it smelled. So I'm thinking, now look, I'm just starting to walk. I got to see all these people I see and speak to them and everything else. And here I am going to have a mess on my shoulder, and I'm smelling. That was kind of shameful, I kind of wished I had gone home and changed clothes. Sin is infinite magnitude beyond that in shamefulness. Sin, when we understand what it is. We may not understand. I didn't understand what that sensation was at first. But as I came to recognize it, I thought, ugh, it smells. Raindrops wouldn't do that. Sin is like that. And the consequences of sin are something to be afraid of. Sin and its consequences is that from which we have been saved. If you are in Christ today, your greatest problem has been solved. You don't have to worry about how your life turns out. You don't have to worry about whether you go into politics and you become a senator or a president, something like that, or else you just have a succession of failures. You don't have to worry about that. Those things are nothing compared to the biggest problem that's been solved. Sin and its consequences is what God saves us from. Now, verse 18 starts off on this note. For the wrath of God is revealed. The wrath of God. Now, that's another kind of old-timey word. What does wrath mean? Well, it has the connotation of indignation, anger, and while God is holy and his wrath is holy, and that makes it not just God's having a fit and punishing people and cursing people beyond what they really deserve, his wrath is holy, and if he's the judge of all the earth, he'll do right in every situation. Whatever punishment there is, he'll fit every crime perfectly. Unlike any nation or locality is capable of doing, any civil government is capable of doing. None of the punishments fit the crimes. You murder somebody, 20 murders. How are you going to give that person justice? Kill them 20 times, dig them up, put them back to life? Can't do it. But God does that. Wrath of God. That's our biggest problem. What if there is a God? Now, let's go back to the first two sinners in the world, because you may or may not believe this. You may think that we, ascended from an amoeba or something like that. And let's just say that we did. Let's just, for the sake of conversation, say that we did. Who set up the amoeba? The universe it's been the cosmic egg exploded and all the stuff is in. Who governed the stuff? You know? How did it all come to this degree of complexity and sophistication? How did that happen? It speaks about a God who made it all. And this God has revealed himself, and he's a moral God, and he talks about right and wrong. And we're wrong with him. We're in the wrong with him. Because if the Bible's account is true, we descended from two people, Adam and Eve, and they committed wrong. They were not made wrong. They were not made innately sinners. They were made good. They were made righteous in God's sight. But by committing sin, they became wrong. And their nature was twisted and distorted. They became sinners. And if we're descended from them, we're sinners. What's God's disposition towards sin and sinners? As far as his holiness is concerned, does he say, that's an improvement? You were upright before. You were naked and unashamed. You weren't hiding anything. Everything about you was beautiful. Nothing was twisted. Nothing was distorted. You weren't ashamed of it. I wasn't ashamed of it. That's all changed now. And God is you know, if we listen to him, he'll tell us. He'll say this very thing to us. Look, don't start going off on me about my holy wrath. You experienced your own wrath before you experienced mine. You hated yourself. You were filled with self-loathing, and you tried to put those stupid fig leaves on yourself to cover it up as though that can make you into a different person. God's wrath is the same. It's nothing new. If we're upset with ourselves, why do we get upset when somebody says, God has a holy wrath, a holy anger towards people? We're not right with him. Oh, what kind of God is he? Oh, he's a horrible God. He's a horrible God. Go back home into your own mind and heart. You're a horrible person. You hate yourself. Everything you do is calculated to distract you from that, to breed in you self-denial so that you don't face it, and to fool other people as well. That's what wrath is. That is what we've been saved from. God's just wrath, his anger against sin. And what is it? Paul breaks it down. What is sin? If we define it, two things. God's wrath is against all ungodliness. That's related to God himself. It's what we sometimes call the vertical relationship. We all kind of know that we're related to one another, but we're all about the same. Some few inches in height distinguishes us, but we're all pretty much the same. This is the horizontal level, relating to one another, people like ourselves. But Paul is talking first about the vertical one, relating to God. Who is God? Who is your God? Do you have a God? Do you think you have a God? Or do you think you don't have a God? If you don't have a God, your God is whatever prompted you and convinced you to come to the conclusion that there was no God. That's your God. You're worshiping and you're following that God. But ungodliness is wrong religion. It's you've got the wrong God. Because everybody's going to worship a God. And if there's no God, and my old history professor at college, we've become met up again and become friends and go out and drink beer together and talk about philosophical things. He said, knowing I'm a Presbyterian pastor, Bill, would you agree that if there were no God in the world, people would still create a God? And I said, oh, certainly. And he started to say something, and he caught himself. He said, wait a minute. I thought I heard you say you agreed with that. I said, I do agree with that. He said, I've never met a pastor who said that. They all get stuck on, but it's unthinkable to think there's no God and start trying to prove to me God. I said, well, you didn't ask me about that. You just asked me if there were no God. We're doing a mental exercise here. If there were no God, would we make up gods? And the answer is yes. We call them cars, buildings, football teams. We create all this crud to worship. We think it all makes perfect sense. I hate your guts because you are for the Pittsburgh Steelers. And I'm for the Philadelphia Eagles. And I'm going to let the air out of your tires. What? What? Why? Wrong religion. It's called ungodliness. You don't think that when you're sitting in the stands throwing stuff and cussing and everything else. You think it's all, I'm worshiping, this is the best thing, I'm the only one right, and all you people over there are wrong on the other side. But it's wrong religion. That's one component, ungodliness, and the wrath of God against unrighteousness. That's wrong living. That's what we do. What we give our hearts and minds to and worship, that's our God. And it's either true or false, for true God or false God, because the world is full of gods. Don't think we've outgrown the gods. Thor and Odin and all the Greek gods and goddesses. Don't think we've outgrown that. We've got our own. They're called Chevrolets and football teams. Those are our gods. Money, national prestige, those are our gods. But what do we do? That's unrighteousness. Now, what the natural person is and does, and by natural I mean everybody. There's nobody here unnatural. Let's just retreat. Having said that the world's full of gods and there's one that's a true God, let's get rid of him for a while and everybody else and just say one thing we can agree upon. We can disagree upon our gods, but one thing we can agree upon here is this. And you tell me if I'm wrong, because I haven't thought everything out to the very end. I haven't thought anything out to the very end. But I'm still open to surprises. So you tell me if I get to learn something new from you today. I'm going to make a statement. You tell me whether it's true or false. You were born from a cat. Is that true or false? Is anybody here going to say it's true? Anybody? Cool. We're already in the same universe. We can talk. You know that. That's what you call natural. That's part of what we call nature. Whether there's a God or not involved or sustaining it, we can debate that. We're unsure of that. You, if you're a Christian, you doubt that probably 1,000 times a day. I do. If you say you don't, I just tell better truth than you do. But we doubt God's existence. If we didn't, we wouldn't do half the things we do that we know we shouldn't do. But what we know is that we were born into the world. And when we're born into the world, every one of us is born against God. Every one of us. And we're busy, and our parents are busy training us into believing there is no God. There is no God. You say, but covenant children are born of believing parents, and they're being trained in God. Yeah, but the believing parents are still sinners too. So you see, that's a two-edged sword. You may have some training about God, but then the parents don't live up to what they're teaching the kids. They don't like hearing that, but it's true. And I'm a grandparent. I don't live up to what I teach my grandkids. I don't live up to what I'm still trying to teach my kids. The one thing I can do now that I never did before is own up to that and say, I try to, and let's talk about that. Okay? The natural person, the one thing that the natural person is and does is cause for shame. These two, ungodliness and unrighteousness, may seem not to be great crimes. They're not going to wreck anybody's economy. They're not going to destroy lives or anything. It may seem like that. You're just talking about, let's talk about your philosophy. Let's talk about what kind of poetry you like and that sort of thing. There's no right or wrong about that necessarily, and it's not going to, you know, kill people. And this may seem that way. Godliness is not a vital necessity, but keeping my job is, we may reckon. But wrong living may be admittedly a problem calling for restraint. See, let's again keep God out of the picture here. And in case you think I'm being facetious, God doesn't mind getting moved out of the picture when we're doing so in search of him. And there's nothing better than, listen to this, nothing better than killing God. Nothing better than doing that. Don't be afraid to do it. Go ahead, kill him. We already did it once, and he came back. Go ahead and kill him. Put him out of your mind. Say, I'm going to start tomorrow. I'm going to wake up. I'm going to exclude God from my life for 24 hours. Go ahead and see how that works, and see how miserable you're going to be through the day, and how incapable you're going to be to exclude him. So let's put him aside here and say this. Okay, let's go back up and give it a fair hearing. Unrighteousness, right and wrong. Yeah, that too we can agree upon, can't we? I mean, nobody here disagreed about being born of a cat. We all are in agreement there. Here's your next question. I come and I just grab you and take the money, all the money you've got on your person right now. Okay? I do that. Right or wrong? No rights? We're still in the same universe. We're still in agreement. We can talk. Yeah, the unrighteousness. Paul has something to say about something in the real world. We thought he was a religious dreamer. We thought he was a fake, a myth maker. But he's talking about something that we do understand. We do have a problem there. It calls for restraint. That's why you're driving home, you got a speed limit. Now, I could do easily 100 miles an hour down Collie Avenue. My skill level is there. But not everybody else's skill level is there. And there's some people whose skill level is beyond that. You drive 150 miles an hour. The road would easily support that speed. But you can't do it. It's wrong, given that there are other people in varying degrees of skill on the road. So it's wrong. It needs restraint. It needs reformation if things are out of whack. You know, murders are committed. You've got to do something about that. You've got to change that. Lies are told, contracts are broken, people suffer economic damage because of it. You got to reform that situation. You got to make it right. But nothing less than the wrath of God is directed against them. It may seem like we could fix those problems ourselves, but the wrath of God is directed against them. They are great crimes. We're not saved from trivialities. The gospel isn't about a dream. The gospel isn't about something just for children and old women and foolish old men. It is revealed. This wrath is revealed, Paul says. Now that's a bold statement. Let's go our next step and see if our unity breaks. Do you see it today? Do you see the wrath of God today? Somebody seemed to say yes. How have we divided here? When you said yes, what do you mean yes? Point it out to me, whoever said yes. It's just bread and wine, Dale. You've lost your feeble mind already. These are words that are just surrounding that. I'm weaving a spell, you know? No, that's no wrath there. There's no wrath there. I'm talking about seeing, not faith. You need faith to see what you're talking about. And faith is what we're all a little bit critical of at this point. It's part of the fairy tale. If it doesn't work, if it's not real, I'm getting rid of it. I don't like unreal things. Okay? Well, let's not be afraid. If God's unreal, let's get rid of him too. Let's kill him for a day. See if you can get through it. The wrath is revealed. Not just will be revealed, as hellfire and brimstone preachers say on the street corners, you know. The day of wrath draws nigh. They've been saying that for 2,000 years. What is nigh? How do they define nigh? Near, it's supposed to mean. Where? Near? No. But God is showing his wrath. How do we see it? How do we see it? How do you think we see it? Are you looking for flames in the sky? Are you looking for? What are you looking for? That's what Paul's going to show us. He's going to show us ourselves. Well, how's the wrath of God tied up in that? He's going to tell us. So let's just keep moving on. God currently curses sin. The way of the transgressor, therefore, is hard. People who know this gospel, people who embrace it, people who believe it, people who seek to live by it, tend not to live an easier life necessarily, but they find themselves, even if they're surrounded with a bunch of afflictions, there's a peace, there's a comfort, there's a joy in it. They are better people. We are better enabled to endure even the furnaces of affliction. But the way of the transgressor is hard. I'm in trouble. What am I going to do? I gotta get out of the trouble. I got to do everything I can to get out of the trouble. Lie, cheat, steal, beg. Do whatever I need to do. But what is the trouble? You don't have a new enough car? There's plenty of honorable people who drive old bangers around. What is the trouble? Don't have a big enough house? Jesus didn't even have a house. And whatever else you make about the biblical account of Jesus, even if he's a made-up character, he's a very admirable character. Exceedingly admirable. Intoxicatingly admirable character. He didn't live in a big house. What is it? Back to you. It's your shame. It's your shame. That's what makes life hard. You're ashamed. And so you've got to wiggle out of discovery. Wiggle out of and apologize for and vilify other people when they begin to suggest you're wrong. You're not perfect. You're not right. That's the way. The wicked flees when no one pursues, because he's fleeing from himself, ultimately. He senses also pursuing divine wrath, because, you know, it ain't easy to live without God. It ain't easy to kill the real God. I'm a preacher who doesn't do a lot of marketing, you know. I'm just predisposed to being what some people would call lazy. But what I actually am is trusting and efficient. I think it's easier to build a house with tools than it is to use your own hands to do that. So I use tools such as prayer. And I use tools such as the greatest power that any human being can be entrusted with, and that's love. And love, it's a sick thing, really, when you think about it. Love sets you up. Because if you know somebody loves you, you're going to blossom like a flower. You're going to open up and spill all your secrets to that person. Because you know you're safe with that person. So, that's what I try to do. And I don't need to hit hard the wrath of God to scare the daylights out of you. Because you know what happens when that happens? People who are already in the fig leaves are going to jump into the bushes to intensify their hiding from the one true and living God. But even in there, the fear is still there. Does he know where we are? Without repentance. And repentance can't come unless God gives you eternal life. The Christian life is a gift. It's not what you're argued into. It's not what the bill of goods you're sold. And you take it. And all these nice people around here, I like them, but they come with some baggage. They want me to believe in this Jesus Christ. Okay, I'll say that I do. That's the way churches are built. But we try to discourage that here. We prefer reality. Without repentance, that is to say, without God giving us new life, and that new life, we realize, I'm changing. I have been changed, and I'm going to change my living. Now I worship. Where did I get this life from? What changed me? It's God. It's the true and real God. And you know what? When that happens to you, you're not caring anything at all about what God this is. He could be evil for all you care. You just know somebody has shown you love. And even if it's fake and temporary, you're just going to just revel in it. But it's not fake and temporary. When you find yourself touched by this living God, you become godly. You want to know more about him. And you become righteous. You begin doing things that are right instead of wrong. But meanwhile, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven, the highest place from heaven, against all ungodliness and unrighteousness. How extensive is that all? What does that mean? I've said today things that have offended you, right? Because you know I'm exaggerating when I say that you were born a sinner hating God. You know that's not true. Don't you? If you're honest, we'd still be in our unity. You'd say, yeah, I do know that's true. As a matter of fact, I do know that's true. We don't shed our lies and our self-delusions, our deceits, and our diversions. We don't shed those easily. How extensive is the all? It's so difficult to come to the bottom of it all that Paul is going to go through three chapters. The rest of Romans chapter 1 deals with obvious sinners, obvious unrighteous people. Okay? And we could all look at people. If somebody's out there robbing a 7-Eleven, you're not going to say, there's a godly soul. I'm going to go to him for counseling. You're not, just not going to do that. So that's obvious. But then you got good people, good godless people. These are, you know, musicians, poets, engineers, people who make a good living, politicians. Well, I mean, everybody knows they're evil. They don't count. They may be in the chapter one bit. But they too. The wrath of God is revealed against them. They too are ungodly and unrighteous. But even the religious unbeliever, chapter 3. So it's all. All is all. God doesn't look at some sin and say, that sin, I can't get rid of all sin, but that's one sin I'm sure going to focus on. And I'm going to have my people focus on that. And that's going to be the sin above all sins that we're going to eradicate from the face of the earth. Because it's the worst. The rest of them aren't so bad. No, it's all sin. All sin. Jesus says, you're walking around. You may be a Pharisee, you know, a religious, high up religious person amongst the Jewish people. You've never cheated on your wife. You've never gone to a prostitute. You've never taken another man's wife. Even for one night only, you've never done that. And you're walking around and you hear this man talking. Yeah, oh, here's that guy. I've heard about him. Let me go see what he's saying. And he says, if you even look at a woman and lust after her, you've committed adultery. Now, if I'm that Pharisee, I'm leaving that guy right away. He's touched me in a place I don't want to be touched. So I'm going to say, no way. That can't be true. That can't be right. I at least have resisted the overt action. Jesus says, yeah, but you still have the impulse. That's the root of it all. We know this about ourselves, and so we get busy. Paul has told us, and we followed his thinking here, and I've tried to make it clear, and I apologize if I've messed it up. But even that's okay, because God's able to clarify things himself. And if you find yourself hanging a bunch of stuff on me, you know, that illustration was an apposite. And that one would hurt my feelings, and it wasn't loving and all that stuff. You go ahead and try that. You could do that. It's a cheap shot, but you could do that. He said, you ain't going to get out of God's clutches, though, that easy. So knock yourself out. Make me your prime enemy. You're still going to be nervous, still going to be ashamed, still going to be trying to bob and weave and dodge God. We know we have a problem. We know we have these problems. But we try to change them. So our ineffectual guilt-compounding attempt at salvation is what Paul goes on to describe in the whole rest of this chapter. And it's clear, it's very clear, and just needs a few things pointed out to understand it. Remember, we've already touched on this, Adam and Eve, they put on some fig leaves. They realized God didn't come on the scene. God didn't bring conviction to them. What we see in them was not conviction. It wasn't God convicting them. They convicted themselves. They knew something's wrong. And let's see. They still were, you know, their minds are still working. They're thinking, what's happened? Something's changed. I'm now ashamed of myself, and I'm ashamed of you. So let's put on something to hide the shame. What's the problem? Guess what? We're naked. That's the problem. But you were naked all along, and you were okay with that. Well, let's not think about that. We can't solve that. What we do know right now is we're naked, and we don't like it. We might have liked it 5 minutes ago. We don't like it anymore. What's the solution? Put on leaves. Just disguise ourselves. How does that change you? What has happened is that you've gone from life into death. You've gone from mental, emotional, spiritual life into death. Are you going to put on a fig leaf and that's going to change it? No way. But that's what Paul describes here. Because in verse 19, Paul says, I don't need to argue you into the existence of God. That which is known about God is evident, not just in the world. The world is showing that there's a God. The complexity of it, the order of it, the economy of it, everything. The closer you look, the more you think, if this is chaos, it's the most beautiful and elegant chaos I've ever imagined. No, it's in them. We carry around our own problem. Adam and Eve. God approaches. So what do? They hide in the bushes. That's going to make things even better. Yeah, real. No, it compounds the guilt. Because now God is drawing nearer. He's not going away. It's not working. It's not working. Now he's going to kill us. He said then the day that we disobeyed him, we were going to die. He's going to kill us. And he speaks. Where are you? What he says. Where are you? Where are you? Now God knew where they were. But God didn't come on as though he knew. Because here comes an aspect of God that we're very uncomfortable with. It doesn't fit into any neat doctrinal category. It's called the love of God. Where are you? Well, I've disobeyed your commandment. Never mind that. Where are you? And why is God asking that? The story, and again, if it's a fairy tale, it's the best daggone fairy tale that's ever been concocted. The story doesn't show us an enraged God saying, get your shameful behinds out of there and let me just dash you to pieces. Where are you? Come out, let's talk. And God proceeds to tell him, I'm going to save you. What you've done, and some of the features that now you're going to have to live with as a consequence of what you've done, pain and, you know, the world not being so friendly towards you anymore, thorns and thistles and all of that is still going to work together to bring your salvation of the seed of the woman, the seed of the woman. Eve is the cause of it all. This is what men think. This is what men feel. This is the way sin works in all men. I hate women. I hate them. I hated the first woman I knew. She was always telling me what to do. My mother would say, Billy, don't go down in that swamp behind the school, down the block there. Don't go down. I hated her. She's never been to the swamp. She doesn't know what great treasures I could find there. I hated her. And we grow up hating them. Our sisters we hate. They get tender treatment that we don't get. This is men. This is in all men. We hate women. Adam said of Eve, the woman, get her out of here. The woman, she's caused all the problems. That's what the problem is, the woman. God says the woman, it's going to come of a woman. Of the seed of the woman will be one to save you all. God is not our problem. God is our solution. God is not our enemy. God is our friend. God is not after us to destroy us. He could do that any time. The rich fool thought he was safe from God in the gospel. But God said, you fool, tonight your soul is required of you. God can suck a soul out of a person any time. You can't count on your next breath except by the common grace of God. So, all people try and evade this God, even though what's evident is evident within them. How do we know this? Because God made it evident to them. I don't need to convince you. And don't waste your time trying to convince me you're some sweet saint. I know your secret because I love you. That's the secret to knowing a real person. I know your secret because I love you. And the secret is you're just like me. And we're all in the same boat. And we're all facing the same guilt and shame and fear that's only relieved not by a fairy tale. I mean, you may as well drop LSD. That'll be fun for a while. Go ahead and try it. That'll be fun for a while. This could be fun for a while if it's a fairy tale, but it's not going to save you. And after all, this book doesn't say it saves us. It points to the God who is the one who saves us. God made it evident. You want to know why you can't sleep at night, why you wake up afraid? You want to know why you're ashamed? God is making it evident. If you're ashamed, you're already conscious of being in a moral universe. There's a right and a wrong, and I'm on the wrong side of things here. There's a good and a bad. I'm on the bad side of things. God made it evident. Since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes and eternal power and divine nature. I remember when I was in college, my faith was being challenged, and I was leaving a physics class, and I'm thinking, man, you know, physics professors pretty well explained everything. There's nothing left for God. We don't really need a God. And then I'm walking across the campus, and I'm thinking, how do I account for the fact that I don't just sink through the ground I'm walking on? How do I account for that fact? Because if what's true about atoms and their composition, that in fact most of the mass of the world is apparent rather than real, it's because you have the electrons going so fast they look like a big ball, but inside it's tiny, tiny, tiny. That's the mass. How does that work? And then you start wondering about leaves and flowers and things. Flowers? What good are they? What do they serve? Well, bees. Well, why bees? Why have bees in the world? And on you go. God is saying, just start thinking about how did it get here? What's its purpose? How could it have possibly gotten here in any way other than a God? This seems to be a key that unlocks the door. But even, here's our response, verse 21, even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks. These are the two failures. See, our problem is pretty simple, and it's all the same. Doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter what you've done, it doesn't matter who your parents are, your anything. We're all in the same boat. Ungodliness, wrong relation with God. Unrighteousness, bad actions. With this verse, they, even though they knew God, what was the response? They did not honor him as God. I don't say, thank you. You've come into the world not to kill the world and judge the world, but to save the world. Thank you. I didn't honor him as God who made it. Thank you for making the world. I didn't honor him with my thanks for his redemption, saving the world, saving sinners. And wiping away our shame. and putting to death our fears. But the sinner keeps seeking to blind himself to the truth. His awareness of truth, he doesn't want to say, yes, that is true, there is a God, or his accountability to the truth. Well, if there is a God, you know, I'm not accountable to him. Ignorance of God, though, and of his law, is no excuse. You might want to go around the bend higher than where they say 35 miles an hour, anything higher is unsafe. You might say, I'm going to do it at 50. And then you find yourself sailing through space. You've run off the cliff. You think, whoops, I forgot to calculate in certain physical forces here. My ignorance is no excuse. You don't get a rerun. Well, okay, now that you realize you made a mistake, the car zipped back and you get to try it again. No, you're gone. You're going to die in a car crash. Because of your ignorance, it's no excuse. It's the cause of the problems. The sinner would make himself a victim, would make himself ignorant, but he'll find himself guilty still of sinning against God and sinning against others, because the truth is undeniable. Through conscience, God makes it known within us. Through creation, the creation is singing out and saying there's at least an intelligent designer of all this. Through natural revelation, penetrating man's closed eyes, but not to bring us to salvation. It only makes us without excuse. I knew all this, but I didn't obey it. I didn't accept it. And so the dynamic of sin goes on in verses 21 to 23. Ungodliness, the root of it all, and to unrighteousness, not honoring God, his person, and his not giving thanks for his works. True heinousness of sin becomes apparent when we consider against whom it is that we sin. Now we're going to bring God into the picture. We've excluded him. Who have we excluded? He's the maker of it all. And when we ruined it, he saves us. And if he saves us, how does he do that? Just say, oh, I forgive your debt. He does it by taking our punishment that we deserve. He saves us. So who is it that we're trying to blot out of our awareness? Well, it's this one true living God. Christmas gifts. What do you think you'll get this year? How big will it be? How expensive? How much love will be poured into it, you know? A new house, a new car, that's pretty big. An airplane, okay, that's pretty big. What about a new life? What about all of your wounds healed, all your shame, all your corruption taken away, all your guilt, all your debts, you being made a super conqueror over all things, and you're never going to, death is only going to make it better when it comes. That's the difference between the gifts of men and the gift of God. Unrighteousness is injurious to men, including ourselves, because we trade certain knowledge of the true God for our own vain speculations. And that's where we're left if we exclude God. My opinions are as good as yours. And that's the history of the world. You think, that's not true. I respect your opinions. You respect my opinions as long as they correlate with yours. The very least they have to do is not challenge and confront yours. They have to at least be able to coexist. But you don't respect my opinions when they conflict with yours. And I don't respect yours when they conflict with me. And I will make nations from family and tribe. I will make states and nations and atomic weapons to back up this conflict. And it's as plain as day for anybody to see. It's the history of the world working out on such a massive scale that you'd have to be insane, blind, deaf, dumb, dead, not to perceive it. The result is that we become fools. without this God, and our hearts become dead and darkened. How much lower can we descend than that? From this, we're saved. Only God, through his gospel, can bring that salvation. Amen.